Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm John Milford, Chair of the Club's Grown-Ups Forum and your host for today. It's my pleasure to extend a special welcome to any new club members who are here. We know you'll enjoy your membership and look forward to seeing you often. Now, here are some of our upcoming Grown-Ups Forum events. On Wednesday, April 22nd, Suzette Sherman, CEO, founder of Seven Ponds, will be speaking on Nobody Likes to Talk About Death, Yet a Cultural Paradigm Shift is Taking Place, where the macabre reaper of the past is being replaced with a contemporary progressive attitude toward end of life. And on Thursday, May 7th, Chris Farrell, author, senior economics contributor, economics commentator, columnist with Bloomberg Businessweek, Next Avenue, and Star Tribune, will be speaking on the fact that we're on the verge of a broad, positive transformation of our economy and society. The old idea of retirement is not working, and it's going away. The boomer generation is increasingly embracing unretirement, continuing to do some kind of work during the traditional retirement years. These are just two of the many upcoming programs, and I invite you to check our website for a complete listing of our events. You may register for these programs online at commonwealthclub.org or by calling the club's 24-hour reservation line. We are recording today's program, so please make sure now that all cell phones and portable devices are turned off. And now I'll begin today's program. Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm John Milford, Chair of the Club's Grown-Ups Forum and your host for today. We also welcome our listening audience and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished panel leader and moderator, Molly Steinert. Molly is the Executive Director of Stepping Stone, the largest provider of adult day health care in San Francisco that enables frail seniors and disabled adults to maintain their health and live independently in their community. Prior to this, she was Executive Director of Open House, where she led efforts to build better access to aging services and housing for LGBT seniors in San Francisco. Her career has spanned over 30 years of community activism working on issues ranging from civil rights to health care to international development. Molly is an appointed member of San Francisco's Long-Term Care Coordinating Council, San Francisco LGBT Policy Task Force, and a board member of the California Association of Adult Day Services. Please join me in welcoming our moderator, Molly Steinert.
Good morning, everyone. It's so great to have such a great turnout this evening. I want to, before I introduce the panelists, I wanted to find out from our audience how many of you are caregivers? And how many of you work in the technology industry? And how many of you are technology users? And how many of you are caring for or are involved in a parent's aging process? And how many are anticipating and looking straight on to their own aging years? We have a few intersections here of interest, which is great. And our panelists are going to be able to respond to some very interesting issues. But let me introduce our panelists today. We're very lucky to have Dr. Richard Caro, is a physicist and teaches physics at Stanford University. In addition to being a scientist, he is an inventor with over 24 issued patents and has started a number of tech companies bringing products to market in fields such as medical devices, telecom, digital health, and photonics. In particular, his work right now is a co-partner of Tech Enhanced Life, which we may be hearing more about. Brad Creed is a research director at the Institute for the Future to help companies and nonprofits forecast the impact of large-scale change in health and technology and to spark the thinking and innovation needed for the future. He has led research on markets, science, and emerging technologies that impact the future of human experience. Christina Irving is a licensed clinical social worker at the Family Caregiver Alliance, a nonprofit here in San Francisco, where she has been a family consultant for over 8 years, conducting in-home caregiver assessments and supportive counseling to family caregivers. She also teaches classes in dementia and self-care. As I think about this topic we're going to be talking about tonight, we know most people overwhelmingly want to stay in their homes for as long as possible as we age. And as we live longer, this will present more challenges that technology is bound to address in launching new models in geriatric care. I think the quote by Mae Sarton is fitting. The trouble is, old age is not interesting until one gets there. And it is getting very interesting. As the boomers come of age, witnessing their parents struggle with aging or finding themselves facing it head on, it is no wonder that new technologies are intersecting with aging. And as we move from tracking our steps and monitoring our sleep patterns and our hearts and tracking our brain, more and more people will want to be engaged and play an active role in managing their health. Products and services are being demanded to support independent living. These labor-saving devices can lower costs in managing health care and address the shortage of caregivers. And so let's begin. I'd like to ask Richard the first question, but feel free, any of you, to respond. Richard, how has technology and aging changed over the last 10 years? Can you talk about that? Well, actually, I'm going to ask you to talk about yourself first.
Okay. No, that's all right.
Go ahead and give us an overview. That's what we're going to do first, is ask each of our panelists to tell a little bit about the work that they do, and then we'll get into the questions.
Okay.
Thanks.
I might just stand up. Would that be all right? Do you mind?
Absolutely.
You know, if I was 6 foot six, maybe I wouldn't need to stand up. You could still see me. Can everyone hear? So I thought what I would do, Molly said we were allowed to have 5 minutes at the beginning to just say something. And rather than telling you about me, I'm going to try and mention a few themes that I think would be interesting for us to explore during the panel, just to throw them out there. But before I do want to make one comment about me, which is that Molly was very kind and said that I taught physics at Stanford, but that's not quite true. I did 25 years ago, but I don't now, and I haven't for quite a while. But I used to be a physicist, so maybe that's close. So let me tell you a bit about something I'm personally very interested in that I think is relevant to tonight. The theme is, you know, caregivers and technology. That's how it's described. I think there's another dimension of technology and growing older that I also want to mention. I think there's this whole idea of pushing out the time at which our functional ability to do things starts to decline. So think about stuff like hearing, seeing, walking, thinking. you know, eventually all of those start to deteriorate a bit, right? Happens to everybody. Doesn't happen at the same speed with everybody. And I have this belief that if deployed well, clever new, quote, widgets embodying technology could push off the time at which that happens. And, you know, I have a whole talk I give about this that's on the internet, actually. You're welcome to see if you're interested. Ask me afterwards. So I'm not going to go into the details, but there are already a few examples. You know, a hearing aid is a perfect example. It's not new, and it means you can push off the time at which being able to hear less well than you could before starts to get in the way of having a good life. And I think there's all sorts of interesting things to talk about different functional abilities and how technology could make them not get in the way so quickly. So that's my first theme that I'd like to just throw out that perhaps we'll explore. The second thing I do want to mention, just so that, you know, I think it's good sometimes to understand where the people talking to you are coming from. And Molly mentioned some bits about my background. One thing I do want to say is I and some colleagues have started this website called Tech Enhanced Life because we feel like this is a very complicated space and there are new technologies emerging all the time. And the only way at the moment to find out which ones work and which ones don't and which ones are best and which ones might work for you is to wade through the marketing material from the different companies. So we decided there was a role for a sort of independent, objective place that would analyze all that because it turns out it's quite a lot of work. And so we're trying to do that with Tech Enhanced Life. And so that's kind of the advertisement, if you like. But that segues into the next point, which I wanted to make, which is that the first thing we thought we would look at formally is a new class of products that we call activity tracking home sensor systems. And this is something I think we also might end up talking about tonight. So I just wanted to paint a picture of it so we, you know, the basics are in place. This is a class of products. There are more than 15 of them on the market, and they involve little sensors that get distributed around somebody's home. They're supposed to be very unobtrusive, and they're meant to kind of almost magically keep an eye on what's going on in the house. And they're meant to notice if something, quote, is abnormal, and then they're meant to tell somebody. So this is very different to the button you push if you fall over and break your hip. This is the sensors are just noticing if something's not right. And it's a very complex subject. It's interesting. We can maybe explore it later tonight. We ended up deciding it was much more complicated than we expected. And Mary Hulme, who's in the audience over there, and I ended up writing a little ebook on it. And on your seat, you can see that too if you're interested. From that piece of work, we learned some things that I think are very generalizable and relevant to tonight. And I'm just going to mention a couple of them. The first one is that it's really not about products. We started off with this bucket of 15 different products that all seemed interchangeable. You know, we couldn't tell the difference. When we got into it, we decided it's really about the people who are going to use them. And we decided that the only way to get to the bottom of which ones worked and which ones didn't was to start with this group of kind of personas that described, in our case, five different types of situations, types of people that would be using them. And when we did it that way, we found that it became much easier to understand whether any particular product would be relevant for that persona. So out of that work, we didn't come away and say, this is a good product, this is a bad product, but we did come away and say, if one's looking for something like this for this type of person, then here's the two that are relevant. Whereas if you're looking for something for that type of person, here's what you should look at. And I think that's a lesson that's very relevant in this whole space. The second point I want to make is that with that class of products, which are all about, you know, observing, monitoring, whatever, we kept finding that there was this interesting dichotomy. On the one hand, between how much one was worried about something bad happening, and on the other hand, between the privacy of the person, the older adult in this case. And so, for example, in the case where the older adult was functioning well in all dimensions, you know, and you weren't too worried, you were just a bit worried, then you worried even more about, you know, invading that privacy. On the other hand, when the older adult was quite ill, you know, advanced dementia, for example, or somewhere along the in that direction, then worrying about invasion of privacy sort of was still important, but became less important than making totally sure nothing bad happened. And, you know, those are two. I have a slide, you know, that I sometimes show, which is like a balance, you know, a balance beam, to make the point that you can't have both, actually. They're sort of, you know, you've got to give up one or the other. You can either have perfect information about exactly what's going wrong at any minute, but no privacy, or you can have perfect privacy, but you don't know what's going on. My final point, and then I'm going to stop, is one topic that often comes up is, well, is this technology instead of caregivers? And, you know, I wanted to head that off because that's really, I don't think it's a terribly useful conversation. I think, in my mind at least, the reason this is so interesting is that technology, if deployed right, in the right forms, not necessarily in the form of a computer that you sit in front of, the potential it has is to augment the reach of a caregiver. So, you know, if the caregiver can't be there 24 hours a day, maybe the technology means they sort of aren't quite as absent as they were before. Or if one caregiver can only look after six people right now, maybe they could look after seven if they had the right technology. So I'd just like to plant that thought in your minds as we go forward. And that's all I wanted to say. Is that good?
Stand as well here. So let me give a little bit of a brief introduction into for the future, and then I'll just kind of likewise share just a few sort of opening points and opening ways that we think about this issue and this intersection of technology, caregiving, and aging. So Institute for the Future, our goal as an organization is to look 10 years ahead to help people make better decisions in the present. The idea is that oftentimes when we're dealing with problems in the short term or kind of focusing all of our attention in one place, we miss things that might just be a minute beyond our reach or just be a little bit beyond our reach. But if we give ourselves space to look up and look around, we can see things differently. So that's the intent of what I'll be talking about. So it's a little bit meant to be a little bit further out and meant to sort of stretch your thinking around time horizons. And in Institute for the Future, a lot of what we're doing is looking at connections between social factors and technology. So the work that we do in health is really deeply rooted in understanding people, and then deeply rooted in understanding the technical foundations and really understanding how they fit together. And I think it's probably helpful to, like Richard, share a little bit about my background. I came to Institute for the Future after several years working in the healthcare world as a reporter and then in the health technology startup world. So when I came to Institute for the Future and kind of continued to have this sort of mindset with my work, of really sort of a mindset of, you might think of a care provider, somebody in the healthcare world, somebody who thinks essentially like somebody in the medical enterprise. And so for me, I had a really interesting moment a couple of years ago when I met my then girlfriend's father, now father-in-law. And before I had met him, I'd been told a little bit about his background, of course. So he was diabetic, had survived melanoma in his 30s, had a pacemaker implanted. It was colon cancer in his 30s, melanoma in his 50s, had a pacemaker, and was diabetic. And he's now in his 70s. And that was what I knew about him. That was all I was told. And as somebody from the medical sort of background, not a clinician, but somebody whose most of his job is working with people in medicine, my picture was of somebody who's going to need a lot of support, somebody who probably would have trouble getting around, somebody who's kind of constantly going to need attention from his family. And so when I met him, the person I met was a guy who bikes every day for about an hour every day. He plays in a band and volunteers actually at senior centers, playing in a band, playing music at senior centers. And the favorite thing that he and I do together when we go down and visit is we go to the gym together. And as best I can tell, the reason we go to the gym together is he wants an excuse to exercise in a socially appropriate way and he can't really make that socially appropriate excuse to exercise unless I'm along with him. So that's why he goes to the gym, and that's who he is. And seeing that really kind of stretched my own thinking about, you know, we think about who are we designing for? That's a question Richard raised. Who are we designing for? And I think the first point is when you look at statistics, like the huge, massive gap in caregivers that we face, or the huge sort of influx in people who are aging and Alzheimer's and neurological impairments and all of the sorts of really scary statistics out there, it's very easy to feel overwhelmed. And I think that makes sense because they're overwhelming numbers. But for me, when you start from a standpoint of who is this person? What are their assets? What are the things that they bring to the table? You get to a very different standpoint very quickly. So we're both looking for, you know, what's the need? What's the kind of the medical challenge or the health challenge or the caregiving challenge? But who is this person? What are they capable of? What excites them? What do they want? And so our first point, or my first point, is really we need to expand how we think about caregiving, not simply from a needs-based standpoint, but also from an asset-based standpoint. Now, my second point, I mentioned kind of my framework is thinking about social factors, technological factors, and understanding how they come together. So my second point is that the tools to help people in new ways and help people manage their health at home and help caregivers manage people's health at home are getting cheaper, and not just a little bit cheaper, but kind of at an insane level of cheaper. I don't know if that's correct grammar. I want to do a quick poll here. So think about an iPhone 5S. It's a $100, you know, standard cell phone now. So a group called Tech Policy Daily deconstructed an iPhone 5S, and they said, what would this cost in $1991? And that was their question. So it's a $100 phone. So just a quick, how many people think it would be more than $1,000 in $1991? So most people, okay. How about more than $10,000? A couple people. Okay, how about more than $100,000? One person in the back there. So the answer, and you probably guessed because I'm kind of leading you to an answer, is that it was $3.6 million in 1991. So that, I think, is a scale of change we're not used to thinking about, right? Like we don't think, I have the newer version, so I don't know how many extra $100,000 this is, but I'm not used to thinking of myself as carrying a several million dollar device in my pocket. I don't think most of us are used to thinking of ourselves as carrying that kind of horsepower in our pockets, but that's fundamentally what we're doing. And I think you could even argue that that's actually an understatement of value, because in 1991, there wasn't a thing called Google, there wasn't a thing called calendar alerts, and on and on and on. So you could really play that out and say $3.6 million really massively understates the amount of value that all of us have access to right now if you have $100. Now, the point here that's really interesting from a technology and caregiving and home health standpoint is that it's enabling us to embed all sorts of technologies into simple objects around our house. And that's sort of a wave of things that we're just starting to see emerge. So at Institute for the Future, we look at for these things called that we call signals. They're really kind of early innovations, things that are just emerging that, for us, tell an important story about where we see a direction of change happening. So my two favorite examples of this, or my two favorite signals of just how you can think about technology very differently. One is something called the Lift Lab Spoon. It was designed by somebody around here in the Bay Area who had a friend who had a tremor from Parkinson's. And he realized by outfitting a spoon with some simple motors and some kind of simple technology, he could counteract the effect of the tremor so that somebody with Parkinson's could now feed themselves, even things like soup that are very, very hard to feed. And it's about, my memory is, I can't remember if it's $100 or $200 now for a spoon, for these spoons that do this. And you could argue that's a very expensive spoon, and it is a very expensive spoon. But you could also argue that that's a lot cheaper than paying somebody to feed somebody. You could also point out that now somebody can go out to dinner and not feel a stigma. And that's a whole big benefit that I don't know how you monetize that or capture that. But it really changes how you think. The other favorite example I have of this is something called GlowCaps, which is a smart pill bottle that recognizes that most what in the medical world is called non-adherence, which just means for those of us who aren't doctors, it means you forgot to take your pill. So it lights up when you're supposed to take your pill, and then it makes a noise at you when you're supposed to take your pill. And the understanding is that for most of us, if we forget to take a pill, it's not non-adherence or non-compliance or being kind of, you know, thumbing our nose at the medical system. It's just that we're busy and we forgot, or it's easy to lose sight of things. And so it just does that one simple thing, and it's now, and you can connect it back into the medical enterprise. You can capture data from it. But it's a way of thinking about caregiving, I think, very differently, or what we can know and measure very differently. So that's kind of the technology framework that I use. And to a point Richard was making, we can think about augmenting reach of caregivers. We can also sort of think about this in the context of what someone named Katie Fike at a group called Aging 2.0 talks about is reallocating people to the highest value tasks in caregiving. So, you know, feeding somebody with a spoon may not be the highest value task. So my third point, and then I'll head back down, is that, and this really picks up on a lot of what Richard was saying, is that the technology and the design intent really matters. So a couple of years ago, one of my colleagues, Richard Adler, who's been working in this space for a very long time, had this realization. He went to an Apple store, and he saw that the Fitbit was sold out from the Apple store. And you know, you think about an Apple store and the retail, you know, dollars per square foot kind of stuff that they get. It's so hard to get into an Apple store. You have to be one of these great, you know, hot products to get into the Apple store, and you couldn't get a Fitbit. And you know, the same stuff that you press a button to summon a caregiver, to summon an emergency alert, 40-something and 50-something people are kind of trying to sort of, you know, force that upon their aging parents and almost can't get them to use it. And fundamentally, it's the same exact technology. There's a few tweaks. There's some technical differences, of course, but it's basically the same technology. The difference is that the Fitbit is an aspirational device and the other stuff is non-aspirational. And so the point is, it's almost like, what's the design intent? How do you make something aspirational? How do you make something engaging? How do you make something appeal to people as opposed to make them feel like they're kind of, it's being forced upon them? Within that, and this is my last kind of little point here, is that when we think about caregiving, and this is just an observation of how we should be thinking about this design going forward, is that we're really good right now. We have lots of really good designers who can design things for individual people and fill your need or make it personalized just to you. But caregiving is really a complex set of tasks involving lots and lots of different people and lots of emotional things and lots of technical and day-to-day and tactical stuff. And so the last real point here is just that as we sort of start to approach this landscape of some really, I think, exciting technologies and sort of really exciting ways we can help people, I think the real opportunity is to think about how do we design for groups of people rather than just the individual.
So as Molly said, I'm Christina. I'm with Family Caregiver Alliance. And most of my time really is spent day-to-day, either one-on-one or in groups with family caregivers. So that's really what I wanted to do is take technology and put it in the context of what it means to be a caregiver. When Molly asked the question earlier of how many people are caregivers, we saw a fairly low number raise their hand, but then the other question of how many of you are involved in caring for or supporting an aging parent, it was a different group. And I think that sometimes the issue is, what does it mean to be a caregiver? And really, when we talk about family caregivers, we're talking about the unpaid family, friends, neighbors, people who are supporting somebody who is aging or has various disabilities. And it can be things as simple as helping go to the grocery store, transporting someone to a doctor's appointment, helping them take a shower and get dressed, helping them make meals, manage their medications. So it's a full range of tasks that somebody who is a caregiver is doing. And a lot of people don't really identify that as a caregiver. This is just what you do for family, or I'm just trying to help out my neighbor. So there's a lot of tasks that caregivers are doing, from kind of the day-to-day basic activities into really medical care. Caregivers are helping with medications. They are managing feeding tubes. They are checking blood sugar levels and giving insulin. So they're doing a lot of very complicated tasks that they don't always have a lot of training and support around. So when we look at technology, we want to look at it kind of from two different sides. Some of it is, how do we help caregivers provide care? How do we help support them as they're taking care of their loved ones? So that might be pill boxes. It might be reminders to take medications. It might be the home sensor technology to help them monitor a loved one who's living alone. But the other side is using technology to support the caregiver themselves. So caregivers are their own people. It's not just an extension of the person who is needing care. So that type of technology might be things like online support groups. It might be the Fitbit for the caregiver to help make sure that they're getting exercise, to help them monitor their own nutrition and their own healthcare needs. Because we know that caregivers have higher rates of mortality and morbidity than non-caregivers, which means they're more likely to get sick, and they often die sooner compared to non-caregivers. And that's for a number of different reasons. It's due to the stress of taking care of another person, how that affects their physical health as well as their mental and emotional health. But it's also due to the time that they spend providing care for their loved ones, how often caregivers have not seen their own doctors for their own checkups. So when we look at technology, it can be used to help them provide care, but it can also be used to help support them. But we also know that it's a challenge. This is a really growing field. There's constantly new technologies that are out there. And often the question is, well, why aren't caregivers using it? Why aren't some of these technologies kind of everywhere in people's homes? Some of it is it's new and it's unfamiliar. A lot of it is also just the overwhelm and the daily stress that caregivers experience. There's a book out there for people who are caring for someone with dementia, and it's called The 36-Hour Day. And that really describes the experience of caregiving, not just for dementia, but for a number of different conditions. That to-do list that a caregiver has is almost never done. There's never a day that a caregiver usually goes to bed and says, okay, well, great, I got everything done I needed to get done today. So the idea of looking into, evaluating, trying out new technology is really difficult. So I know it's a mix of people who are here listening to this, and what we want to think about is if we're in the field of supporting caregivers, it's also supporting their use of trying out new things and helping them figure out what's really going to be useful for them. So Richard's description of the different personas and which persona or which technology best suits a particular persona is a great way to think about it. What are the needs of an individual caregiver? Again, for taking care of themselves as well as taking care of their loved ones. And what's a good technology fit for that? And how can we help caregivers kind of weed through what's out there? How do we help them figure out what's going to be the best fit for me? Because there may be a lot of great tools out there, but if it's not going to make my life any easier, then that's just one more thing to do at the end of the day. And how can I help them actually start it? So for someone in this room who is not actually a caregiver right now, but you know a caregiver, that's really one of those things that you can do to support them. Say, I heard about this one piece of technology, this new gadget, this new website, and can I help you set it up? Can I help you put this in place and try it out? Because that's really often the challenge with caregivers, is what they'll say a lot of times is, I'm getting by, I'm managing, we're doing okay. It's not necessarily the standard of living we want people to have, as I'm kind of getting by, but that's what they're really having to live with day to day, because the time to try out new technologies isn't there. These are people who don't have the time to see their own doctor, who the idea of going for a 10-minute walk is just too much. I can't handle that. So the time to research and investigate technology is really difficult for them. So we want to try and provide that support to caregivers to help them figure out really what's going to be the best fit, what's going to make my life easier, not just be one more thing to do. So it's great that more people are interested in this topic, because we want to kind of demystify it so that as more people know about it, it's easier for those caregivers to get support from others about what's available and what's out there. And how do I evaluate, again, kind of what my needs are? Because it really needs to be a fit for that individual caregiver, and not just it's a great and interesting tool. And thinking about technology on the full spectrum, it can be very high-tech home sensors. It can be the pill boxes that actually text you to let you know that medication was taken that day. But it could also be, you know, just the basic pill boxes. It can be an alarm on the door that it's not going to an alarm company, but it just beeps when mom opens the front door so that I know that she's gone outside and I need to go and get her because she has dementia and she might wander. So there's lots of ranges of technology. So I think it can feel very scary and overwhelming, and this is all really high-tech stuff. It doesn't always have to be super high tech, but we need to bring it back to the caregiver, the senior, the person with disability, what are they needing to really support them, to make their lives easier and to manage their stress? And realizing that you do have two people in that role. You've got the caregiver and the other person. So we want to make sure that we're providing support to each of them individually, and acknowledging kind of the caregiver's needs as well as their need to take care of another person.
Thank you, both, all of you. Getting back to Richard and my original question, I thought it would be good to put it in context of this moment in time that we are seeing an explosion of technology and aging. And think back 5 years, maybe even 10 years, where we were at. What's the evolution of technology and aging? Some examples of how we've been thinking about it in the past to where we are now in that discussion.
So I think there's a few, is this on? Can you hear that? No? That's better, I think. Can you hear me down the back? So I think there are a few interesting points to make on that. And the first one is that I think this word technology, we have to be slightly careful what we mean by that. And so to answer the question, I just want to explain that in my mind, technology is kind of about the bits inside a product. And it's also about what you could make if you put your mind to it. And then there's a specific product, which is something you use to do something, something you care about. And I think those are a bit different. And I want to use that to answer the question, because the underlying technology that could be in products has changed enormously in the last decade. Partly, it's much cheaper, as you heard, right? But also, it's much more powerful. And so that $3.5 million cell phone, another way to say something similar is, you know, it has the computing power that 10 years ago would have been called a supercomputer and would only be available, you know, in a handful of places on the planet. So what technology can do is enormously different. But now I think maybe the real question you're asking, Molly, is are products in aging that have technology in them, you know, how have they changed in the last decade? And to be a bit controversial, I'd say that, you know, if you focus on products that are actually being used, as distinct from the ones that you read press releases about, I'd say they haven't changed much at all. You know, I see people recording things on bits of paper. You know, when someone has a smartphone, it's considered incredibly radical. You know, you hear about people starting up an iPad class in their older adult residential community now, this year. It's an incredible innovation, but the iPhone was invented almost a decade ago. So I think products, almost no change. Technology, enormous change. And I think that's where the opportunity is, because I think there could be amazing products. And it's partly just a timing thing. You know, people are certainly developing them now. You read about every day there's a new press release. Some of them, I think, maybe not quite focused, but I think there's going to be a lot of good stuff.
Thank you. And Brad, can you describe what the Internet of Things means?
Oh, sure. And I mean, and I think that that's a really good starting point there we go. Sorry about that. So the basic idea of the Internet of Things, and I think Richard's point is a really good one of distinguishing between sort of technical capabilities and the actual products in our lives, or the actual things that we're doing with those technical capabilities. So the Internet of Things, the basic idea is to connect stuff to the Internet. I mean, that's a tautology, but the idea is that you can equip basic objects with a bit of intelligence. You can connect them to the Internet, and then you can actually access anything in the Internet. You can kind of go back and forth. So my favorite example is right now, my favorite example is not at all in the healthcare space. It's a little toy dinosaur that's being developed by a company called Cognitoys, and they put this on Kickstarter. And what the toy does is it has a little Wi-Fi connection, and it connects back into Watson, the IBM supercomputer in the back end. And then the toy can talk to a child. It can ask the child age-appropriate questions. It can age with the child. It can do all sorts of things. And the actual technology on the toy dinosaur isn't that great. What it's doing, though, is connecting into one of the most sophisticated forms of intelligence in the world. And so it's a very kind of interesting back and forth. So at a basic level, that's kind of what it is. It's the ability to take something and connect it back into a larger network. In health, I mean, I think that there's a lot of really interesting demonstration projects, and I think this is the point Richard's raising, is that there's been a gap between what's really taken off and what's really possible. So more than a decade ago now, when I was working as a medical reporter, I remember coming across what at the time seemed like a really new, really innovative clinical trial around heart failure. And the basic point is that if you are a heart failure patient and have a sudden spike in weight, it suggests you're likely retaining water, which is the sort of thing that will probably kill you if you don't address it pretty quickly. And so this intervention, the thing that was being studied, was connect the scale to the network, trigger a nurse to call somebody if there was a spike in weight. That was the thing that was being studied. As best I can tell, that still is not really part of standard clinical practice in this very one obvious use case. And you could really go down a huge number of use cases like that. But so I think at some fundamental level, what's interesting is that you can start to think about all of the ways that we can capture data in the home, and then all of the ways that we might want to interact around that or might want to give people information. And of course, there's dangers of information overload and all of those kinds of things. But that's, I think, the real opportunity, is just turning the home into a point of interaction rather than a static place.
Thank you. Christina, when you look at the patient and the caregiver, you may find technology answering some of the needs of the caregiver, but how does that person aging alone in their home begin to use technology that would really support them? And is it available to a very older population that may not be versed in computers or gadgets or that's not part of their world? I think of my mother, who would not be very open to anything new. And I'm wondering if you see it a generational shift that's going to bring technology to an older person aging.
There's definitely some generational differences. I know with my grandma, we were trying to introduce like an iPad or the computer to her so that she could get emails, because as grandchildren, we were not as good about calling as much as she would have liked, and she refused to touch them at all. So I think as the generations age and as different people are wanting to use technology, we're going to see those changes. But there are a number of the senior centers in the city that have computers, that are teaching seniors how to use computers, that are teaching people with disabilities how to make some of this technology accessible to them. So I think regardless of generational differences, there are just changes as this is becoming so commonplace. There's more of an openness and an interest in using some of these more, you know, high-tech or now just commonplace gadgets. So there are some differences. I think, you know, to go back to kind of Richard's point earlier, is that technology is not meant to replace caregiving. It's not meant to replace that human relationship, but it's how can it be used to add to it, to make people's lives a little bit easier. So things like the sensor technology, the senior or the person with disability, they don't necessarily need to be doing anything with that, but the caregiver would be able to access it. So you don't need to have both parties comfortable with that type of technology. It's one versus the other. So I think when companies or individuals are designing and creating some of these new products, you hopefully are taking into account what seniors and people with disabilities, what their comfort level is and what they're able to do and use in terms of button sizes, recognizing that when people have dementia, you're not going to teach them to use a new product that they haven't used before. And that's oftentimes what we'll see is, oh, there's this great app for people with dementia. And it's like, okay, I could see it'd be great. And maybe for somebody who has early onset, who has used this type of technology through most of their life, they might be comfortable with it. But I think that's where people really need to understand the context of the care situation that they're in to know whether this technology is going to be useful to them. Because, again, it could be the greatest product in the world, but if it does not fit our situation, what my needs are, and what the needs and abilities of the person I'm caring for, then it's not going to be useful. So we don't want people to get flooded with every resource that's out there, but to understand how those resources, those products can help them, and to really start by saying, this is what I need. This is what would help me and support me. And it might be another person, or it might be a technology. So I think we just have to make sure that people really start with what do they need and what are their abilities, and then go from there in terms of looking at technology.
Thank you. Are there any devices that you've seen that can be helpful for people with cognitive decline that are helpful?
There's definitely, in terms of when people have cognitive decline, I think the ones that I get the most questions about are kind of the GPS monitoring for the concern of someone with dementia who might wander. And, you know, the biggest one, I think, when it first started to come out was the GPS shoe. And it does exist, and it is out there. It's not the nicest looking shoe ever, so I think you'd have trouble getting some people to wear it. We've seen that expand to now GPS insoles, to ways for people who do carry their smartphones around all the time, different apps that people can use. So I think that's the one that we hear the most questions about from caregivers who are worried. But again, it can be as simple as an alarm on the door that lets you know that somebody has wandered. And if you're living with the person who has dementia, that can be useful. If you're not living with the person and they're very early stage, things like the sensors might be helpful. So more of the technology for cognitive impairment tends to be monitoring the safety of the person, not so much technology that the person with dementia tends to use. Or if they're using it, they're using it with the caregiver. So things like music therapy apps. Well, the caregiver's doing that with the person with dementia. So it really is more about supporting the caregiver in their role as opposed to always just what the person with dementia is using.
Can I just expand on that, though? Because I agree with all that. But I think there's another interesting emerging dimension, which we'll see. It's still in the research phase. But there are some academics around the world working on various ideas relating to using specific types of carefully designed games to enhance neuroplasticity. And, you know, the potential there is perhaps to improve cognition, and there's some work that suggests that that will be effective at different, you know, with different degrees of dementia. So there's no products, I don't think, or at least none that I know of that work for sure, but I think that's an interesting direction.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and just one other actually that I think is worth thinking about. So there's, and this is kind of a broader shift that we're seeing in design in general of recognizing that people have built-in cognitive weaknesses, regardless of who they are. You can be 5 or you can be 100, and their biases and ways that you navigate the world and blind spots. And so one, I think, real big opportunity, and I always think about it, I worked in college in an industrial print shop, and there was a very large paper cutter, and you had to cut 1,000 sheets of paper at once with a very, very heavy blade. And so to do that, you had to push 2 buttons that were shoulder width apart. And the reason is that it's very easy, if you're not paying attention, to try to straighten the piece of paper and cut your finger off. So Pitney Bowes, or whoever the manufacturer was, decided, you know, let's make sure that doesn't happen. Let's put these 2 buttons apart. So it's a very common design trick in safety to design for that kind of let's guide people. But I think it's underexplored, I think it's just a really underexplored area of design and sort of merging that with technology, of thinking about how do we sort of take that idea of 2 buttons that are shoulder width apart and sort of expand that to things like plates or, you know, in the house. And just one quick example of a plate I saw recently was from a Stanford design school that had different colors because, I guess, as I understand it, dementia often inhibits the ability to see color, and so food becomes less distinct from the plate itself. And so these plates had very bright colors to accentuate the food, make it easier for somebody to feed themselves. So that's a very, very low-tech way to think about design that's pretty interesting to me.
Well, in that regard, what is your experience of involving older adults in the actual design of technology? Because often discovery is really based on having to figure out what you need or someone you care about needs. And yet the practicality of really understanding a person's situation may involve actually working with older adults. And I'm wondering if you have a sense of how that works, either one of you.
So that's interesting because we have this theory that it's quite hard to develop products for older adults unless older adults are involved. That's not a theory everyone believes in, but we think it makes sense. And so to test this out, we've been running what we call these circles, discussion circles. There are five at the moment in the Bay Area, and they're all in four of them are in large residential communities of older adults, and one is associated with a church social group. And the typical age is sort of 80 of the people in these groups. We had a couple of people over 100 come to one of them. And what these groups talk about at the moment is challenges to do with growing older that they would like to see fixed. So they're really about identifying problems right now, which, you know, for those of you who have been involved in developing new stuff is where you're supposed to start. You know, that some people just go off and develop a solution without worrying too much about what they're trying to solve, but that's doesn't usually work very well. So we're starting with the problems. We hope to find a way to take that and eventually have actual products emerge with these groups of older adults and other people continuing to be involved. What I've found is that there's quite a lot of appetite and enthusiasm among this demographic for being part of this process, so it's quite exciting.
Yeah, and I think that that's I would echo that we're always kind of looking for how do you engage people in the process. I think the only other thing I would add is that we're also looking for unmet needs or things people don't say when we're doing kind of focus groups or user interviews or ethnographic work. And maybe I need to be a little further away here. But when you talk to somebody and they don't tell you, you know, something that they're very clearly doing and they don't tell you that they're doing it, it's almost sort of an interesting data point of that if you can listen for the things that they're not saying. So for instance, I did some ethnographic interviews several years ago where I was interviewing a woman in her 30s, and she kept not telling me that she was doing the chores or that she was cooking dinner or that she was taking care of the kid. And I kept having to stop her and say, well, who's doing this? She said, well, of course I'm doing it, not my husband. And it became very clear that there was this gender dynamic that was so built into the interaction that she just wasn't thinking about it. But that's the other thing I listen to in addition to what Richard cited is, what are people not saying that actually tells you something really important if you're just looking for it?
Christina? I think to add to that, you know, there are oftentimes, especially for caregivers, because there are so many things that they're just doing, it's routine for them. So you really, if you're either helping a caregiver identify what products might help them or you're trying to design something, you really have to dig sometimes to get to the root of what's going on. And then when you add culture and on top of that, you're going to see certain topics that are either taboo or just something you don't talk about with outside people. So having that sensitivity to know how to ask those questions, is mom having some problems with her memory? Because it might be within this family or within this culture, we don't talk about dementia. That's seen as a mental health issue, and no, that's not okay. But you really have to know kind of the culture of the person and the family to make sure that you're really getting to some of those underlying issues that somebody may not feel as comfortable just bringing up openly. I think when Aging 2.0 did one of their Stanford design challenges, they had a person who had early stage Alzheimer's speak at it so that the design competition participants could ask those questions. And you saw some people who really understood what that meant to have dementia, and other people, based on their questions, it's like, you need to do a little bit more kind of immersion or a little bit more understanding so that you can design a product that's really going to be a fit for this person.
And perhaps we have to slow down a bit in that listening process and really be with people in their setting and in their environment and do that listening on a very deep level. So I'd like to take a moment to transition to opening up questions and answers to the audience. John?
Right now, we'd like to remind our listening audience, this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California. You're listening to Technology Coming of Age, with an expert panel led by Molly Steinert. And now, Molly, can we take questions from the audience? All right. Please wait for the microphone.
Thank you. There's an area of caregiving that I'm very interested in as is the whole area, but one particular area that's challenging is oncology caregiving, because in that caregiving, often if it's done by a family member, there's almost a near certainty of death or rapid physical decline and possibly cognitive decline. Is there any resources or information regarding oncology caregiving from a product development standpoint, or just anything that we can read or put our fingers on?
Okay. I haven't seen, in terms of product design, anything specific to oncology. I think most of the time it really is looking at, again, what are the needs of the situation of the patient or of the caregiver, and how do you meet those needs kind of across different diagnoses or different health conditions. Oftentimes it is about monitoring someone's health, whether they're stable or whether we expect to see a decline over time, whether that's due to cancer or any other kind of chronic health condition that's going to see that progression. So I haven't seen any specific products that are geared just towards a cancer or an oncology program. I think most of the kind of more of the technology on the online side is, yeah, there are a number of websites specifically for cancer caregivers. And that may often be kind of online support groups. Again, so it's not so much about how do you take care of the person with cancer, but how do you help support the families as they are supporting the person with cancer. So not on the product side, but on the website, in terms of networking and creating those support systems.
And those websites that provide a way for you to organize help when you're a caregiver are really valuable and can really help the caregiver manage the crisis.
Hey, so first of all, thank you for a very insightful discussion. So the whole thing about technology having progressed in leaps and bounds, and yet having analyzed it, I find that integration into the marketplace, especially for this customer base, which is caregivers and the older population, has been much slower than we would have liked. Could you address the challenges that you see in technology integration? Has it been cost to our people in terms of funding, waiting for outcomes data? Has it been legal risk to it, or what do you see as the biggest challenges to these?
Well, sort of all of the above. I think a good way to think about it is that two things. First of all, there need to be some customers. And so this is a bit tricky because often the older adult is not the customer. The caregiver may or may not be the customer. Sometimes there are, you know, there's a whole layer of aging care services that might be supposed to be the customer, but perhaps that's not really what their business model is about. So that's one aspect. Then second, you know, new things usually require significant investment, and there are fashions in investing, and until recently, older adults was not a fashion. Actually, it's becoming one now, so that's a good sign. I think those are two things. And then the third thing is that, you know, really new stuff always takes a decade or so to get there. And so partly one just has to be patient.
I'm following up on the discussion on finding how people are using products that you just talked about and the discussion groups that Brad mentioned. Are you finding that seniors are developing some of their own or things that could be advanced technologically just based on compensating, and they're not even aware that they're doing that? They may not tell you they need something, but they're creating something because they're compensating for a need subconsciously?
So I don't have a – I mean, that's a really good question. I don't know if either of you have specific examples. It's workarounds is actually one – when we're also doing user interviews or that kind of research, that's always one of the things that's really kind of one of the most telling things for us is what is the – if somebody's doing something that takes them 20 minutes to do or 30 minutes to do every day and is kind of seems burdensome and tedious to anyone else, it's kind of a really useful data point. So several years ago now, this back in 2008, we first started talking to these people who called themselves the Quantified Self Group, the Quantified Self Meetup. And what that meant was that they liked to make really detailed spreadsheets of the ways that their body weight and blood pressure changed on a daily basis. And to me, when we encountered these people, first, like really, that's your idea of a good time, is you make an Excel spreadsheet? Okay. Now, it turns out that if you look at it, what they were doing was creating the same kind of data that you now get through a Fitbit or through, you know, what's called wearable computing or wearable technology. But it was this like workaround that told you there was something there. So I don't have a specific aging or caregiving example. I don't know if either of you do. But it is definitely the thing that I think tells you a lot of an unmet need that there's a real opportunity to address.
I have a couple of examples, actually. One that's sort of aligned with what you're saying. Often in our circles, there's a discussion about the annoyance of TV remote controls. And I must say, I don't think that's related to older adults particularly. But anyway, it always comes up. And there are several images that we've been given, which, you know, it's the complicated TV remote with bits of paper stuck all over it, with only one or two buttons left available. All the rest are covered over with something. That's an example of a workaround. But then something that I was going to mention that's a little bit different to what you asked, but I wanted the opportunity to say it, is one of the – there's a lady who comes to a lot of our meetups who I don't think is in the audience tonight, who has early stage MS and decided that she – you know, but she's not – she's quite young. And she wanted a walker because she needed one to be able to go off and, you know, do things. But she wanted to go off exploring in the hills and things, you know. She didn't want to be just shuffling along the corridor somewhere, you know, with under the fluorescent lights with the tennis balls on the back. And so she went off with her own money, and she found a designer, and they've developed a prototype of what she calls an all-road walker. And it's got big springy wheels, and it can go over bumps and things, and it's really amazing. So it's not a product, but and it's not really a workaround, but it's an example of people fixing their own problems. I think that's the right answer myself.
I think the closest I can come up with, I had a caregiver whose mom was a very high fall risk. So she really needed help to get out of bed or get out of a chair. She needed someone with her. So they do sell these mats or pads that you can put down on the floor so that if somebody is coming off of a bed and they put their feet down onto it, it sets off an alarm to let you know this person has gotten out of bed. She was not aware those existed, but she found in a pet store the ones that you put onto a couch so that if your dog jumps onto the couch, it sets off an alarm so the dog jumps off. She used that same one. And they're actually a lot cheaper than the ones that they sell geared towards seniors who might fall out of bed if they get up on their own. So I think caregivers tend to be very creative, and they find things that are either already existing or they kind of come up with their own.
So the question that I have is, you were talking about your care circles and discussions and the importance of involving older adults in the development and identifying what the products are that are needed. And you mentioned these discussion circles drawing from a lot of people living in community. And my experience, and I'm wondering and I'm asking if you know otherwise, that a lot of the focus groups are drawing from older adults living in community, and certainly living in community mitigates a lot of the issues of living home alone and what the challenges are for older adults who are not in community. So I'm wondering if you know of focus groups or people who are engaging with older adults who actually are not living in community but are living at home alone.
So I'd just like to say what I was talking about is not a focus group. A focus group is when people developing a product go and try and engage a group of customers. So that's a little bit different. The circles that I'm was mentioning are really a sort of effort to really engage the adults in not just answering questions that about a product someone's already conceived of, but in really being part of the whole creation process. And they're really designed as part of an umbrella organization that we think of as a bit of a collective. So the older adults are part of it rather than, you know, some arm's length thing. That's the first thing. That's not answering your question, though. So we've started these discussion groups. Four of them are in communities. One is not. That's really just coincidental. I think you make a very good point. If you only focused on people in communities, you'd be missing some things. And I think, you know, people that do product research, more formal product research on specific products, I think they do often go to people outside communities, but it's certainly important.
Our time is nearly gone, but I should say, for those who may be interested, the grown-ups forum here is looking to form a discussion circle of older adults to talk about technology and aging. And so there's a sheet of paper on most of the seats here. If you have an interest, if you'd like to fill your name and give us your email address, we'd like to have a meeting on May 4th sponsored by the Grownups Forum about that. So, since our time is almost gone, we have one more question that we have time for. And will the panel stay and speak to the audience for a little bit afterwards?
May I also make one more comment? And one of the things that that really stuck with me, Brad, was your comment about how design is often based on need and not assets based. And I feel like as we age, we want the enjoyment and to continue to do the things that we love doing and to be able to engage with people and community and just our happiness. And that ends up taking care of the most fundamental needs that we do have. And so designing in that way, I think it's going to be the boomer way that we move forward, because this generation is going to make sure that aging is fun and that it is engaging and that it keeps us going through the long haul.
Okay. Thank you, Molly. Well, our time is gone. I want to thank Molly Steinert for being our leader tonight, for our expert panel. And we also thank our audience here as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California commemorating its 112th year of enlightened discussion is adjourned.